So here you're going to be listening to part one of Kilimanjaro Diaries. Now, I've had to split the podcast into two parts because it was just so jam-packed with solid gold content. So in this first part, we're going to be hearing about the preparation leading up to Kilimanjaro, our experiences and approach to the medical briefing, and our reflections on the first few days on Kilimanjaro. And welcome to the World Extreme Medicine podcast. I'm your host for today, Dr. Fionn Davis, expedition medic and emergency medicine doctor. I am very excited about this podcast we've got together for you today, named Kilimanjaro Diaries. So, to give you a little bit of context, last year I was fortunate enough to be invited to support a charity trek up Kilimanjaro as the doctor. This was my first time climbing Kili, and I was pretty excited and pretty nervous. I had been to altitude on a trip before at Mont Blanc, but never as high as this. And Kili is most expedition medics' first trip to altitude, and it's safe to say it's not to be underestimated, for several factors that we're going to discuss in this podcast. I also learned an awful lot from this experience, and I think that has sort of rounded me a little bit more as an expedition medic moving forward. In this podcast, myself and my fellow medic on the trip listen to some of my voice recordings that I made whilst on the mountain and reflect on our experiences on Kilimanjaro. Welcome to Kilimanjaro Diaries. So I would love to know any listeners' thoughts on this. So if you've been up Kili or if you're planning to go up Kili, please send me a message on social media or contact the podcast via the WEM website, or comment on the podcast on Instagram. Or keep an eye out for the blog post and you can pop a comment on there as well. I'd love to know your opinions on some of the stuff that we've discussed on here, if you've maybe had similar experiences or anything that you're maybe worried about if you're going up Kili yourself as a medic, please get in touch. So, this podcast came about because I was recently asked to give advice to a friend of mine who was about to climb Kili as a medic. I found myself scrolling back through some of the notes and voice memos that I'd made for myself on my phone to dredge up some sound advice and some tips. As I did so, it really transported me back to breathlessly recording some of my reflections in my bright orange medical tent, watching the sunset on the mountain out of my tent door, and listening to the hustle and bustle of camp around me. And I felt ready to share this memory, and I thought, who better to share it with than my fellow medic on the trip? Introducing Dr. Francis Screech, expedition doctor extraordinaire, and my good friend. Francis, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello, everybody. Expedition Doctor Extraordinaire. That is quite the intro. Hello. So, what an absolute pleasure it is to have been invited to have a natter on the brilliant WEM podcast with the amazing Fionn. Thank you very much. So, I am Francis. I work in the BRI in Bristol as an ED and Expedition Clinical Fellow. In case anyone's interested, it's a one-year job that I'm sadly approaching the end of, but I definitely recommend it to anybody with a burning desire to get out there and work as an expedition doc alongside their NHS work. I'm starting anaesthetics training in August, though, so I'm joining the hundreds of doctors balancing training with the amazing world of expedition medicine. So I'm hoping through this podcast, I found that there isn't loads of information available for the aspiring Kili doctor. So I think this series and this podcast will give a realistic insight into the trip for us from the perspective of two doctors who I think at the same time had our first experience of altitude medicine. So, Fionn, first of all, do you want to explain why you're recording voice memos in your tent on your own, like a bit of a weirdo?
Yeah, well, I definitely felt like a weirdo doing it, but it's turned out to be quite a useful thing to do. So, firstly, I'm a really lazy journaler, and I know a lot of expedition medics like to keep a journal on expedition as a sort of mental health kind of outlet. But carrying pen and paper seems like extra weight and a bit of a hassle to me. So, I started recording these little voice memos at the end of a day, kind of reflecting on the day. And it was my way of kind of coping with some stresses and kind of offloading rather than writing it down in a journal. It can be really arduous on an expedition and sometimes quite lonely as the medic, and you may not have anyone else to talk to about some of the sort of medical stresses So it's important to have some coping mechanisms and a sort of mental toolbox that you can use that are going to be practical on expedition. So I found it really helpful. And then it's really nice to be able to look back on the recordings and kind of remember what I was feeling and thinking at the time when I was sort of cozied up in my sleeping bag reflecting on the day. How about you? Have you got any other coping mechanisms you like to go with?
That's so wholesome. I love it. So I am a reflector. I definitely lie in bed and I love that bit of expedition. You take yourself through the day and sort of think, yeah, through everything that's happened, good and bad. But I don't actually record my musings anywhere. Maybe I should. I feel like that's quite a productive and useful thing to do. But in terms of relaxation, until I started this kind of expedition journey, I always considered myself to be super sociable. But I don't know, that's sort of waned, I think. Since working on the longer ones, I've definitely realised that I perform best if I've had at least some time on my own. So during Killy, we were usually camped at different spots, weren't we? But I used to grab a cup of tea when we got to camp, when everyone used to sit down. And I'd sit with them for a bit, but then I'd go and take my tea back to my tent. And it was often under the guise of running an evening clinic, which obviously I did do as well. But if nobody appeared, then I'd sit there, read a book for an hour and just have a bit of time away from the group before dinner. I used to think, well, it always surprised me, you just have to be on all the time as the expedition doc, don't you? And I find that, supremely fun, but it is also one of the most exhausting bits of expedition medicine for me, because I think a huge role as the doc is needing to be full of energy and really motivating. And I can do that and I enjoy it, but I do definitely need a bit of time on my own to recharge to actually be able to do that and do it kind of justice. And I think it works. If I have that time, a few people have said to me, why doesn't the altitude affect you? Or like, why are you so full of energy? And you might be dying inside, but you're actually full of bounce and life. And I think, just a bit of time on my own and that conscious effort. And I know that about myself now. So I take myself off for some me time. You definitely gave one reason. Any other reasons?
So second reason for recording voice memos on my own in my tent. It sounds really weird when you say it out loud, but I promise it's not as weird as it sounds. You're going to find out anyway, because you're going to hear the memos. I found it really difficult to keep up with the medical documentation on expedition, which sounds silly, but you are probably asked about 20 million different things a day, about little minor things, or how much should I be drinking, or I've got a bit of a headache, is that okay? Or like, can you just have a look at my foot, or, my rucksack's a bit funny, and you just get my back's hurting, my neck's hurting. You get all these little things that people come to you just as you're walking throughout the day. And if you had to stop and document that every single time that you had one of those little queries, you'd never get up the mountain. So it's just not practical to document sometimes as well when it's sort of like minus 20 degrees. I think that's what it was on our summit night on Killy. Yeah. And you can barely feel your hands, let alone write something down. And you can barely breathe as well. So it's just really not top of your priority list at that point. One of the ways that I record my thoughts, observations, feelings, medical concerns, consultations, is to record myself a little memo at the end of the day, whilst it's still fresh in my head. And it takes like 2 minutes, really quick and easy. And gives an amazing memory of my thoughts at the time, but also something to refer back to when I'm catching up on medical documentation later on.
You actually told me about that little hack on, I think, day two of Killy, when I'd been wrestling with flapping bits of the paper flying all around the mountain. So I stole your plan and recently got back from Island Peak. It was blooming cold and everybody decided to go wrong within about a 48-hour period. And I think trying to write notes at that stage would have genuinely been the straw that broke the camel's back. So yes, thank you for that one. And I do it on every expedition.
Yeah, it sounds like there's definitely a story there. I'd love to hear about it, but we better stick to Killy for the moment.
Killy today.
We could natter all day long, couldn't we?
Love it.
So let's transport ourselves back. We starting our prep for Killy via the Machame route. And just for a bit of context, there are 7 routes up Killy. And the Machame route is the most popular route up the mountain, and it starts from the southern side of Killy. It's one of the shortest, at 5 nights and 6 days most groups do it, but it's not the shortest. There are some crazy ultra runners who do it in sort of, I think, 3 nights, 4 days, something like that. This route starts at Machame Gate at about 1,800 metres and ascends to Uhuru Peak, which you may not know if you've not been to Killy, because I thought Killy was going to be called Kilimanjaro Peak, but it's not. It's called Uhuru Peak, is actually the top of the mountain, at 5,895 metres, so just shy of 6,000 metres, over the course of about 5 days or so. So one of our first jobs when we got to Moshi was, well, let's actually just talk about arriving into Moshi to start with. What were your first impressions when you got there?
Oh my God, what a place. So I love it. I love and sort of crave chaos. When I've been in the UK for a bit long and I feel like I'm stagnating, I just dream of a bit of, you know, exciting chaos. And I think the tuk-tuk ride to my hotel on that first night is something I'll remember for a long, long time. I do think, you know, that exhilaration, you hanging on to your tuk-tuk, doing the death weave through the traffic. So you never admit that to your group, do you? But that's definitely one of the highlights of all of these trips. And I definitely think, apart from my beloved bike, tuk-tuks are definitely the way to travel. And I also remember, I think I got there maybe a day before you, or we hadn't met up because we didn't know each other then. And I found this amazing cafe, all sort of leafy, very beautiful, called the Freedom Cafe. Amazing food, but more importantly, so I sat there all day and read all of their stuff. But they are a charity where they provide jobs for local people who are survivors of sex worker trafficking, and they also provide sort of education and try and build these women back up and get them ready for the community again. So that was kind of one of my first introductions to Moshi. So I've still, yeah, it has a really special place in my heart. I much preferred it actually to Arusha, where I went after for sort of safari stuff. And I think can you remember when we arrived to the hotel, I met you and we met some of those other doctors and they just looked so broken.
Absolutely.
Can you remember that? That was my first warning. I was like, oh my God, what have I let myself in for? And the other overriding thought is, I just felt like such a legend doing a medical kit bag check underneath a palm tree with these amazing bird calls. It felt very warm, balmy, exotic, and I was like, this is proper expedition medicine, and it was very exciting.
Almost as exciting as when we went to the pharmacy and we were like, oh, we need to buy some more ondansetron and some more dexamethasone. I can't remember what else, but we had a whole list, didn't we, of like stuff that we needed.
Poor ops manager was the poor old Simon who came with us was like, I've never seen two people so excited to buy a load of medicines for a kit bag.
I think it was like, so I had bought medications abroad before, but I had no idea what the deal was going to be in Tanzania before we got out there. And then I was super excited when they were just like, yeah, here you go. Have all the meds you need. Codeine, Tramadol, whatever you want, over the counter.
Spent a lot of his money, didn't we?
Yeah, he wasn't excited about the bill. But we were like, these are essential medicines. We need them. I remember you were so excited, speaking of tuk-tuks, you were so excited about your first medical emergency that you got to arrive to in a tuk-tuk.
Oh yeah,
when
I do.
We got back down the mountain and one of your group had a bit of a drama and so we had to go and check it out, and then you were like, call the tuk-tuk, put the blue lights on it, let's go.
It doesn't get better, does it, than a rapid response tuk-tuk. Is that, in fact, I genuinely think maybe that is the solution to the ambulance crisis.
Tuk-tuks. Oh, yep. Weaving in and out of traffic, you know.
Yeah,
not,
easy.
Not great patient transport ability, really.
That's true. That is true.
I remember my one of my first impressions of Moshi was near-death experience in a vehicle. And I just got off the plane. You have to take two planes to get to Moshi. I did anyway. And then somebody met me at the airport and it was in this like van where like the seatbelts didn't work and like, yeah, and the window didn't roll up fully or something. And then I'm pretty exhausted at this point. I've been traveling for like nearly 18 hours or something to get here. And the guy's like doing these really dodgy overtakes and there's sort of goats and cows and children all over the road. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not going to make it. This is where I die.
Before you get up the peak.
Before I even get, I was like, this is probably the most dangerous part of my trip right here. And then I was so exhausted, but I was like, I can't go to sleep because I kept having to think I was going to have to like take the wheel or something. I can't fall asleep. And by the end, I was like, do you know what? I don't care if I live or die at this point. I'm getting some rest. And so I just got my head down on the seat and just hoped for the best. I was either going to arrive in one piece or I wasn't. And that was that. Yeah, that was my first impression of Moshi. And the fruit bats in the hotel, actually, as we were checking the medical kit, there were these huge fruit bats hanging from the eaves of the hotel. That was really cool as well.
That was cool. And we also got a hell of a greeting. Can you remember? There was a lot of photos with the staff. They were just wonderful.
Oh, that was because you were a good-looking white bloke. And they were like, yes, this is my future husband. We need to go and get some pictures with him.
It's true. It's not an effect that tends to happen in the UK, I find, to me. But, you know, there's room for... I quite liked it. I was there for it.
Okay, so hopefully we've set the scene a little bit about arriving in Moshi, some of the crazy driving, the tuk-tuks, etc. And then one of our first jobs as the medics was to deliver the medical brief. And I remember we were conferring over what we were going to say, and we had slightly different approaches to it, but I think it was we both delivered kind of slightly different medical briefs, but pretty much in the same kind of vein of things. Do you remember what we sort of said?
I thought it was really interesting, wasn't it? I think when we were discussing it, we both felt a bit scared because I think it's quite hard. I think it's quite a hard one, that initial brief, to deliver well and to pitch at the right level. I think they're quite rightly super excited, keen to get going, but they're also tired, jet lagged, nervous. And then I think, from my point of view, it was really important and yours too, to introduce all those important topics of hydration, nutrition, blisters, hot spots. And then I think we were both quite excited about talking about the sexy stuff like altitude illness. But you kind of know, if you've done any form of education and with your medical educator hat on, that, you know, someone who's, you know, probably super excited and they're jet lagged and, you know, they've probably been making the most of the free booze on the flight, they're not going to retain much of that stuff. And you also, I was really aware that I didn't want to terrify them too much with the haste and hape stuff, but also wanted them to understand what was going on. So I found I did do, as you did, a pretty comprehensive brief, but then ended up repeating lots of it almost every night. Not, you know, all as one, but various segments as they became relevant, I'd repeat during our kind of evening briefing after dinner. Was that, I think that really helped kind of normalize the weirdness that's going on in your body as you start going up through the altitudes. And I think by doing that, less people would come and see me because I'd briefed everybody that you may feel, you know, these variety of symptoms as we start getting higher. And I think that was helpful. Was that something that you encountered?
Yeah, sort of setting expectations on what they sort of, what would be normal, what would be something to worry about. Yeah, and the repetition as well, really key there. You can definitely tell you've done some medical education, you know, the old spaced repetition is key, isn't it? So, and not to overload them when they're tired and, like you said, excited. And they're not going to take in an awful lot of information at that point at the start of the trip. I think I maybe took just a slightly different approach, a very sensible approach. But I think I was like, right, I've got to keep their attention, keep them listening to me, so I'm going to keep it maybe like entertaining but terrifying sort of thing.
Remember death came up in yours and it didn't come up in mine, but
yeah, I think fairly early on I was like, people die on this mountain, you need to listen to me so that that doesn't happen to you. I've actually got a little quote from this is what I finished my medical briefing with. I'm not sure I would word it quite like this now, but I think it was effective anyway. So I finished with, "This is a challenge. This will be the hardest thing you've ever done, and no amount of words can describe how much you will suffer." It's a strong start, I know. you will have a headache. All of your muscles and joints will ache. You will be unimaginably fatigued and you probably won't sleep well. Your body will be suffering and not operating at 100%. Near the summit, the oxygen level will be less than half of what's available at sea level. All of this will make you feel like shit. And there's not much I can do about that. It's part of the challenge. Embrace the suffering. And I think I said it with a kind of grotesque smile on my face, which hopefully made them laugh, but also kind of made them take it a little bit seriously as well. And I hope kind of put us all in the same frame of thinking that this was going to be hard and that we needed to be mentally prepared for that.
And I think even though I'm sort of giggling at how harsh that is, I think we noticed the different expectations of our two groups as we went up with our different approaches, didn't we? And I think, possibly I needed to be a bit harsher. Talk about the unimaginable misery a bit more.
And how I can't really do much about it. That's part of the
challenge. That was the key. That was the key. Whereas mine thought I had a lot of options.
And you've only got, a small medical bag. You've not got all, you can't solve every single problem that they come to you with. So yeah, it's about setting those expectations. But also I was worried that I was going to make myself seem unapproachable and like a bit of a kind of mean, hardcore medic.
They loved you.
I went for the hardcore briefing approach, but I think I finished it off with right at the end. I want you to come and tell me your best altitude joke as we're going up the mountain. And I love all things plants and animals, so please come and tell me about them, just to, lighten the mood at the end there.
I feel like yours got involved with some singing as well. That definitely lightens the mood.
Yeah, there was some singing, definitely. They're all a bit stunned, but I did want them to be properly prepared for how hard this was going to be. I'm in the process of writing a blog post for my medical briefing for Killy and kind of stuff that I included, because we could definitely talk for probably about an hour about all the different stuff that we wanted to go through within the medical briefing. So keep an eye out for when that's published. A little bit more detail there.
I think that will be really valuable, because I found, like, hopefully there's some people listening to this podcast who are in the, in the lead up to their first Killy trip, and definitely you scour the internet for any information you can find. So I think how to structure a medical briefing will be a supremely useful bit of information.
Yeah, and actually now that I've got that written down, I find that you can just tweak bits for various different trips as well, if it's altitude or not altitude. Okay, are we ready to listen to the first recording?
Oh yeah, let's do it.
Jump into it. So this is taken from Shira camp. This is night two on the mountain. So we've already spent one night at Machame camp. And then I've got up to Shira camp and I started making my first recordings.
So day two completed on Kilimanjaro. Currently tucked up in my sleeping bag, listening to all the noises of the other people in the tents around me chatting. Porter's having their dinner. It's been a good day. We started off at Machame camp, where we walked to yesterday. So we started off at Machame gate. We walked up through really nice rainforest to get to Machame camp, and had the most beautiful view of the sky. I think the best view of the sky I've possibly ever seen. The Milky Way was really clear, and we got some really nice pictures. The group seemed really good. They worked together as a team really well. They're, for the most part, pretty low maintenance. It's proving really important to drink lots of water, at least 3 litres. Keep emphasising that's the group. Champagne coloured pee. Getting on really well with them all. Again, it's sometimes difficult to keep that professional boundary, especially on expedition. But I think that on the whole, I think I've probably got the balance right. I think we all did our sats at camp today. Today was a really good day. A little bit more technical, a little bit more scrambling. Some like rock, kind of rocky path with difficult footing at times, which is kind of interesting. And we were coming up through pine forest, which is really nice, with the most amazing Spanish moss I've ever seen in my life. So much of it and so long. So I bored everybody about moss facts, obviously. And then we got to camp today. I started feeling a little bit breathless on exertion, like struggling to maintain conversation sometimes. A little bit of a headache after a few hours at camp, which is 3,800 meters. Food is really good. Hot food every meal. We had pancakes and omelette this morning. Checked everybody's sats at camp, which I'd say are averaging about 85. Mine are 88. And heart rate about 90 at rest. Definitely feeling that. And definitely feeling pretty gassy at altitude as well. But no diarrhea, so that's good. So tomorrow we are planning to go to Lava Tower, which is at 4,600 meters. It's going to take us about 4 hours to walk there, then 3 hours to walk to the next camp, which I think is called Barranco Camp. Today we walked 5K, but it's very steep. We had a lot of altitude gain. Machame Camp is at about, I think it's about 2,600 meters. So not too high. And the gate was about 1,000. So you can probably hear I'm pretty breathless actually just doing the voice memo. But it's not too bad. Not struggling with the altitude too much. Just taking my time, going poli poli, nice and slow. They say in Swahili. The other Swahili words I've learned are twendi twendi, which is like, let's go. Jambo, hi. Mambo, also hi. Poa, it's cool. Mzuri, it's beautiful. But you can also say kisuri or unzuri, depending what you're talking about. The guides are really good, really knowledgeable, setting a really good pace. It's literally so slow. It feels so slow, but it's actually perfect. I have good faith that all of the group is going to be able to make it physically to the top, but I think a few maybe might struggle mentally. I did have a few throw up this morning, just two actually, but they've been okay for the rest of the day. So not too concerned about those guys. They're managing to keep food down. A few people are losing their appetite a bit, but not too bad.
I love how snuggly and comfortable you sound.
You can hear the sleeping bag rustling around, can't you? Yeah.
You are very happy that you're in your nice cozy down, aren't you?
Oh yeah. You know, when you go away for a cup of tea, I go and get my sleeping bag.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, it's such a treat. And also one of the benefits of being the doc is that tent on your own, isn't it? When you go and they will come and tell you about how dreadful their sleep was in the morning, and then you're like, oh, I slept great.
Oh yeah, and how Evan snores and stops breathing halfway through the night, and you're like, oh yeah, don't worry about that, that's the old altitude.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the things which massively stands out is that that is night two of the trip, and you're already saying, tomorrow we're walking to 4,600 metres. Isn't that mad in terms of ascent? It's just crazy. It's really, really high. I think it's so nice hearing these kind of reflections on the day. When I was just jotting down some thoughts about the trip for this podcast, I think I've written for that first day that it was jungly hot and exciting. Was that your thoughts? It felt felt exotic,
very chatty. They were walking quite quickly, and the jungle was quite cool. I think we saw some sort of unidentified rodent thing on a branch. That was the only wildlife we saw, but it's beautiful flowers, and it's like this big canopy, and it was all quite easy walking, so it was all quite quite excited and chatty at that point.
It's interesting. Mine by that stage we're actually finding it quite hard, and there was lots of alarmingly shiny looking shoes, so I was doing lots of stopping, and already bearing in mind this was day one, lots of taping feet already, because I think it's because of the humidity and some poorly broken in shoes, despite a comprehensive briefing before about wearing in their shoes. Then there was quite a lot of blisters, and people were finding it quite hard already, and I think that slightly increased my anxiety, but they were grand. And an absolute highlight, you mentioned some of yours vomited And I realised that I'd bigged up the importance of drinking, and I still do for every altitude trip, clearly. But I'd obviously, I wasn't very approachable because one of the girls hadn't drunk much during the day, but was obviously too scared to tell me that. So then she vomited in our mess tent everywhere. Like, there was vomit everywhere.
Oh, in the mess tent, not in the
mess
tent.
No, in the mess tent. And this was night one. I went outside with her and we had a bit of a chat about what was going on. And she was like, well, I was really worried because you said we needed to be trying to get sort of 4 litres of fluid down. And she said, I'd only drunk a litre today. So I tried to get the rest down before I went to bed because you said it was really important before we went to bed to make sure we'd had all that. And I was like, right. And she was like, so I've drunk 2.5 litres since we got back. And for context, that was probably over about half an hour. So I was like, have you basically just downed 3 litres of fluid? And she was like, yes. And anyway, we saw that fluid propelled against all the sides of the mess tent. It was lovely. And that was my first introduction of how glamorous the world of expedition medicine is.
Do you remember they would
and
have
yes, I've also written...
Was it popcorn ready?
Oh, yeah.
And you get, no, that seemed to be the snack of choice, didn't it? And then I remember as well, because I never usually drink sugar in my tea, but I did on Kitty. And I don't know what it was. I think I just wanted a little bit of sweetness, but also the calories. And I just needed the little pick-me-up when I got there and I needed a cup of tea with sugar in it.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that you were checking people's sats, and I remember that well. You know, I came to hunt you down, probably for a bit of moral support, on night two, and you were doing a bit of a clinic where you were checking everyone's sats. And I'd started with all these great intentions of checking everyone's sats the whole way up, but I had to stop because mine got so competitive that it became this really unhealthy who had, you know, everyone would compare their sats, and it
was
actually...
Was it who had the highest or who had the lowest? What was the...
Well, the thing is, it started as nothing like that because they didn't really know. And then people started to get anxious and they'd take me aside and be like, I had the lowest sats in the group today. I feel fine, but I'm worried I won't get to the top of the mountain. So I then had to go and announce at breakfast. I was like, unless anybody's unwell, we're not doing any more sats monitoring. I was like, it's not a helpful measure. You know, we're going to go on clinical signs and how you feel and how you look. I was like, and I had to give them this sort of gentle telling off because they were... Yeah, they were getting quite worried about sats game, but maybe yours were more sensible.
There was definitely a bit of competition going on between mine as well, but they were more kind of, I don't know, supportive about it. But I think I can't remember if it was before or after, but I looked up what the evidence was for sats altitude and whether if it was like predictive of AMS or HAPE or HAES, and it's absolutely not.
No, it's not. No.
So it's kind of a meaningless measure, but I think it was... It was the group that, well, the organisation that we'd gone with had sort of mandated that we'd do it. But then, yeah, it's not a particularly useful measure. But, I mean, interestingly, mine, the guy who struggled the most did have the lowest sats. So,
interesting.
On the summit day. So I mean, that's just anecdotal, though.
Yeah, that is interesting. I also feel like I've already painted a, you know, less... than perfect view of my group, and they were absolutely amazing, and I did actually find it really humbling seeing when they were a group of people from the same organization with a few randoms added into, and I found it really humbling that after even day one or whatever they'd be encouraging each other to drink, they'd be checking in on each other, even though that's, you know, we suggested they buddied up and helped each other out, but hearing them sort of sharing sweets for energy, even sharing painkillers and things, it's all quite kind of, I don't know, it was a nice side of humanity to witness, I thought.
Yeah, it is nice, isn't it? When, yeah, I think I say in there, don't I, that I had a good group and they're all sort of bonding and looking after each other. So mine was sort of kind of a little bit younger than yours, I think, on the whole. I think the oldest participant I had was maybe just 35 or something like that. And they didn't all know each other, but they had quite a few meetups prior to climbing Kili. And they were a good group, but then I struggled because they were sort of mostly the same age as me, and so it's kind of quite hard to sometimes keep the professional boundary in terms of, like, I'm the doctor, you know, you need to sort of respect that, but also,
of course,
I'm also doing this with you, and I'm climbing the mountain with you, and I'm your teammate sort of thing. It's quite hard to sort of strike that balance sometimes, isn't it?
It really is. And another really important reflection on your voice note there is the food. I've also written pancakes, fresh fruit. Is that not mad on the side of a mountain? It blew me away.
Absolutely crazy. Couldn't believe it. I was like, right, this is great. I'm getting involved in this.
Yeah, there was often, you have to like your carbs, don't you? And luckily, that is not an issue. I loved it.
Yeah, and I think I've had two people who'd come to me and said, oh, you know, we've been a bit sick this morning on after the first night. And I was sort of like, okay, well, did you have your breakfast? Yeah. Did you keep it down? Yeah. Okay, like, let's keep an eye on this and see how it goes. And then I think the other thing from that first camp I remember was the night sky.
Oh my God, wasn't it like truly stunning, wasn't it?
Go on, describe it. What did we see?
Well, we saw the Milky Way. There was a sudden kind of exodus from the mess tent as everyone went and got there. I'm ashamed to say I've got my mum's old Android, but people with good iPhones were taking some insane astrophotography, weren't they?
Yeah, you could do a little long exposure on your iPhone, which meant that you really got the stars and the Milky Way kind of showing up really amazingly. Yeah,
I used to have to go and get them all to, you know, WhatsApp me their exciting things so that I could pretend it was my own before I put it on Instagram. Yeah, rather than my really dull attempts at it. I also remember having one of those moments at Shearer Camp where we got there. And it was quite windy, wasn't it? But then I just remember you see the sunset and you have Mera Peak in the background. Can you remember that? And I just remember sitting on a rock watching the sunset with, you know, obviously the Serengeti. And I was like, this is about as exotic as it gets. This is incredible.
It was beautiful. Yeah, the sunset was amazing. You had this big, like, because isn't Shearer Cave Camp is kind of on a bit of a plateau, isn't it?
And
you kind of have quite a steep climb to get up there, and then it kind of plateaus out, but you're above the cloud level.
Exactly.
Remember you had all this like layer of cloud laid out behind you with this one lonely mountain poking up through it. And that's one of the other cool things about Kili, is that it's the highest, what do they call it? Highest
volcano.
Like stands alone.
Oh, stand alone. Yeah, yeah, of course.
It doesn't have, it's not part of a range. It's just a volcano in the middle of nowhere with no mountains around it. It kind of means you don't get that much scenery, but actually that night was really cool. And we had that one other mountain that we saw. Yeah, the sunset.
Pretty special, hey.
Yeah, I mentioned in there, I had somebody break a tooth at the gate, and I was like, I hope this is.
Yeah, that's a disaster.
The rest of my trip, yeah, she had a filling, and it just broke straight down the filling.
We don't have a dental kit. I remember that medical kit didn't have a dental thing, no.
We did not have a dental kit, no, big mistake. I don't think I was going to do a lot with it anyway. I sort of said just right, keep it clean, you know, brush your teeth really well, which is another thing that people don't do on expedition because they don't like to go outside when it's cold, or they don't like to like walk unnecessarily to go and find a spot to brush your teeth, or I don't know. But you're caning the snacks and the sugary things and the electrolytes and all this is bad for your teeth, so it's super important to actually maintain good dental hygiene.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I think I just advised her to keep it as clean as she could, and then she wasn't in actually a lot of pain with it, so I wasn't kind of super concerned at that point. And yeah, she carried on fine.
Ouch.
I think, and I mentioned I bored everyone with moss facts up. So we've already mentioned, so the first day you do kind of jungle rainforest type habitat. And then the second day is sort of moorland with lots of moss hanging off the trees and kind of shrubby trees, aren't they? And then at the end of that second day, we had a little bit of a scrambly bit at the end, which was a little bit more fun, a little bit more technical. And then that carries on up the mountain. So this is a fun fact to tell your groups, actually. I remember the guides telling us that you've got these five different habitats all with on Kili.
I love that journey through the different habitats. I really missed the kind of variety when you start getting to the scree scrub that you're on for a few days. I really missed that. You know, you're just like, show me a tree.
I know. Gets really dull after a while. Yeah. And I'd run out of, I didn't have any more rock facts. I had loads of moss facts, but I didn't have any rock facts. So the group were probably quite relieved by that. But Yeah, and then I had this conundrum about that, you know, if you've got somebody who's a little bit slower than everybody else, do you sort of try and stay at the back, and do you sort of, you know, kind of try and support them, but then the majority of the people are up ahead, so, you know, where do you sort of base yourself? But I think I've subsequently now started walking more at the back for most of the first few days to get an idea of who is struggling, who needs more help, and why are they struggling? Are they struggling mentally or are they struggling physically?
Yeah.
I think there is a difference in the approach to it.
I ended up in the same place, yeah. I think at least you know you're going to come across everybody, don't you? Otherwise, if you're at the front, then you can have some stragglers who by the end of, you know, half a day's walking are a long, long way from the group. So yes, I think I'd recommend staying at the back as well.
Yeah, for the most part. And then you can hear how breathless I am in that recording as well, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a thing I've learned from a friend recently who actually did get HAPE on a Killy trip is he was repeatedly, because of different needs from different people in the group, he was running, well, walking fast between the front bit of the group and the back bit of the group for quite a lot of the trip. And obviously we know that sort of exertion at that altitude can be a trigger for HAPE, so I think it's quite important to, as the medic, not, even though you might want to be sort of running around all over the place, making sure you're pacing yourself. I think that's something that I try to do now.
Yeah, and actually if somebody gets unwell at the front, then they can kind of step off the path and wait for you to get to them if you're at the back,
exactly,
rather than you sort of running up the mountain to them, which obviously you can hear how breathless I am.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. I was not going to be running anywhere.
Nah, you'd have it. You've got complete faith.
I remember there was at Shira Camp, there was a toilet that was up a hill. I was like, I couldn't leave it until I was desperate to go to the toilet, because there was no way that I was sprinting up this hill to get to the toilet. So I was like, right, I'm going to go to the toilet. This could be a while, you know, I'll just be 5 minutes as I get up this hill. Right, so should we go on to the next one? So I've mentioned that
I think we should.
We're at Shira Camp. Oh, the other thing I wanted to ask you about Shira Camp is you actually saw the cave.
Oh, the cave! I'd forgotten about the cave. That was amazing. And our amazing guides. No, they took us over there. That was a bit of a lackluster response because everyone was tired. But a few of us went to the cave with the guides and they said, they explained that that's where the local people would have sort of sheltered and had a fire, and where they'd have sort of told stories on the early trips up Kilimanjaro. And it was, yeah, it was amazing. It was a proper cave. And again, there was an incredible sunset outside. So I just remember it felt like one of those pretty special, quite exotic moments.
And I think it's important to say that Killy has variable standards amongst the porters. You were saying, you know, they would have used to stay in the cave, and they quite literally probably would have used to sleep in the cave as they supported people up the mountain.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's I can't remember the name of the group now. We'll have to find it out and put it in the notes of the podcast. But most of the companies that operate on Killy now are signed up to sort of make sure that they're providing a reasonable standard of accommodation, food, and that there's a weight limit on how much each of the porters can carry, which I can't remember off the top of my head. It's something like 20 or 30 kilos, something like that.
Yeah, I thought it was actually 15, but
oh, maybe it's less.
I can't remember. Yeah. But they were, yeah, it was managed. It was managed.
Well looked after. And it had good pay.
And it was strict, wasn't it? When you went in, it was measured.
Yes.
Which was really good. And it was, I just had a quick search and it's the name we'd forgotten is the Kilimanjaro Porters Assistance Project. KPAP, apparently.
KPAP. That's who you got to check that your company is signed up to when you want to make sure that they're looking after their porters. And I think we'll touch on it a little bit later
really important
about where the medic looking after the porters can be a little bit contentious with companies as well. Right, but okay, let's move on to the second recording, which is when recorded at Barranco. So this is day 3 on the mountain, and we had gone up to Lava Tower, which is the 4,600 point, and then we'd come back down into Barranco camp after that.
So today we walked from Shira Camp to Barranco Camp, about 10 kilometers, 800 metres of ascent up to Lava Tower where we had lunch, and then 700 metres of descent. So we're currently on about 3,900 metres, and Lava Tower was at 4,600 metres. I think we had our proper first taste of altitude when we went up to Lava Tower. Lots of people feeling it. Lots of people with headaches, losses of appetite, and one girl who was getting dizzy, vision a tiny bit blurry, coordination not great, but told her to double up her Dymox and to eat as fast as she could into descent, and walked with her most of the way down, and she got chattier and chattier. So let's just take it a day at a time. Another guy had another really bad night's sleep, and tonight is our last chance to get a good night's sleep before summiting. Everyone else is doing okay, a few little niggles here and there. One girl has a diarrhea this morning. Everyone's still in pretty good spirits, I'd say. It was quite a long day today for us, which sounds silly because it was only 10k, but you just underestimate it at altitude, I think. I had a slight headache at Lava Tower. Took some paracetamol and ibuprofen, and got better as I descended and drank lots of water. Still taking the Dymox. Seems to be working. Don't seem to be peeing too much, which is pretty good. The toilets on Kili are something else. They're actually like tiled floor, which is insane that people have actually carried that up and built it. But they're a glorified hole in the ground, sometimes with piss and shit around the hole where people have missed it. Another beautiful starry night tonight. Can't quite see the Milky Way because the moon's getting a bit brighter, but still some really cool tent pictures at night. And we had pizza tonight for dinner. Vegetable pizza, unbelievable, with some pasta and some vegetable sauce and the most delicious pumpkin soup I've ever had in my life. We are eating so well. And maybe you can hear in the background we have a couple of Germans in the group who are all doing pretty well, pretty strong, and in good spirits, which is nice to hear. It's not going to stop me from sleeping. I am absolutely knackered.
Yep.
It sounds already sounds a bit less bouncy and comfortable in your tent, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's a short and starting to, one.
Yeah, starting to feel the strain. I love you brought me back to the Dymox chat. Do we talk about Dymox a lot? Wow, it's definitely one of the favourite topics, isn't it? I think the tingles in my group probably varied from eyebrow, penis, nose, sometimes all at the same time. And sometimes they weren't there. And I had people, yeah, some people worried that the tingles had disappeared and they felt back to normal. They wondered if that was a bad thing. But yeah, it's definitely a favourite topic, isn't it? And I think
I had really intense tingles in my hands and fingers. It was really like distracting something.
Yeah. There. It's pretty full on, isn't it? And I think that day is the first. You're at very high altitude and it's a big, big climb, isn't it? And I think I kind of echo your experiences. I think personally, we had a really challenging lunchtime. I think I remember being really, really busy and just about managing some food. So everybody had a bit of appetite suppression, but powed on, they were great, and a bit of shortness of breath on exertion. But I do remember somebody over lunch vomiting, somebody else having a panic attack, and obviously not managing much food myself. So it was all a bit traumatic. And then can you remember you climb up really, really high and then morale kind of drops because after that absolute beasting the whole group get, you then have to descend basically the same amount. And they all get so sad.
yeah, and they bill it as like an acclimatization day, don't they? But I think that's what I say, it's like the first taste of altitude when you get up to Lava Tower. And yeah, I remember lots of my group not really wanting to eat. Lots of them had headaches. some people really struggling with like severe headache. Well, I say severe, it makes it sound like they were sort of going down with haste, but just, you know, the
AMS-y head.
Headache of the trip. Yeah, so people getting a first proper taste of altitude. But then most people, by the time we got back down to Barranco, were fine. I think I actually found it challenging because, yeah, so I didn't feel great at Lava Tower. And then when we were going down, I had to sort of coach one of the girls down. She was very just quite slow, struggling a little bit. But
it was quite a long sort of, you needed quite, yeah, and you needed good good balance. And to be someone, if you weren't someone that did a lot of walking, I remember it was a long descent over quite bouldery fields, wasn't it?
I think on the knees and on the legs, it's harder to go slower on the downhill for me personally. I think it, I find it almost more tiring, and you're out for longer, you're sort of in the sun for longer. And yeah, the weather on Killy, so I think we were probably very lucky, but we had beautiful weather every single day, clear skies, sunny, probably 20 to 25 degrees maybe in the daytime. So we're all sun creamed up, wearing hats and sunglasses, but then obviously very cold at night, just loses the heat really, really quickly. So yeah, I was sort of out for quite a long time that day, so I think that's probably why I was a bit knackered.
Your nod towards the pizza. I know we can't talk on the WEM podcast too much about food, but pizza halfway up Kilimanjaro, and it was really good as well.
It was really good. That is exactly what I needed. I needed to be told that at Lava Tower that there was pizza at the bottom.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, of course. And I think it was either here or the night before where we all discovered Milo in a big way. So Milo's that powdered hot chocolate stuff. And my group found
it. Rip-off, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it was like my group discovered it in a big way. I mean, by the end, everyone was demanding Milo more than anything else. I think probably if there was sort of a randomized controlled trial, I think they'd find Milo to be more addictive than crack, probably. They were all hooked. But yeah, like yours, I think lots of people were getting headaches, a bit of diarrhea, nausea. They were also getting a bit of the cough. I did encourage buff wearing, but they're not pleasant to wear, are they? So a few people were starting to get a cough.
You don't mean like a hape cough, do you? You mean like a
Dusty cough, yeah. Yeah, feeling otherwise well, but just a cough from the dust. And then people did start wearing their buffs a bit more religiously, but I've become a bit more strict on my on the buff wearing now, because I see how damaging the dust and the early days can be.
Yeah, definitely. And then we've mentioned again like sleep. So people start sleeping poorly at altitude, and then that kind of has a knock-on effect of morale, energy, fatigue, which we were advised to use the Lake Louise score by our organization, but you ask everybody if they're fatigued, they're like, yes. It's like, have you got sleep disturbance? Yes. Do you feel breathless? Yes. Do you have a headache? Yes. It's like, oh, well, this is not a very useful score then, is it?
Yeah, let's send everyone down. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think, it's much more a sort of clinical judgment, isn't it? But I did think for my group, it was at this stage as well that I'm sure you had the same. They started to, there was a lot of questions about the summit night, and people were getting very focused by now because it suddenly looms, doesn't it? It feels like it's quite a long way away, and then suddenly, oh, it's tomorrow night, essentially. It's mad.
Oh, yeah, it is, isn't it? They've only got one more day, and then it's the following night. Yeah, yeah.
That used to cause, because of obviously technically it's a different day, but actually they're only going to bed for 3 hours or 2 hours.
I think I say that, don't they? That this is the last good chance for a good night's sleep within this reflection. Okay. So then we had the next day, which actually I think was a bit of a highlight for us, wasn't it? It was quite fun.
We loved it.
Going up the Barranco wall.
If you've got a bit of an outdoorsy bone in your body, then definitely the Barranco wall, I think, is a highlight. A bit more technical and fun, isn't it?
Yeah, right, okay, let's hear about it. Let's see what I've got to say.
Barranco to Barafu camp. So we start in the morning nice and early, as always, 5:30 wake up, and we climb Barranco wall. Just a really cool little scrambly bit. lots of hands involved, lots of cool footwork, kind of polished rock in places, quite steep, quite vertical. And it was quite a challenge for people who had a problem with heights. But they managed to do it, so really proud of everyone. And we had a really nice view at the top. We had to move super slow because it was so vertical. And we were all struggling to catch our breath. We then had a little bit of up and down, kind of undulating ascent and descent across sort of alpine desert before we got to Karanga Camp, which is where we had lunch. And normally in the 7-day Machame route, you would stop at the Karanga Camp and you would stay a night and acclimatise. We didn't do this. We carried on to Barafu Base Camp, which is where we were going to start our summit night from. And I think in retrospect, though, it would have been quite nice to have a 7-day route and to have a little bit more time to acclimatise. The climb up to Karanga was quite steep. It's quite a sort of 20-minute incline before you get up to Karanga, which is about 4,600, I think, in total.
And that is where we're going to have to leave it for part one of Kilimanjaro Diaries, leaving it on a cliffhanger, like all good podcast hosts, to make sure that you tune into the next episode to hear what happened next on the mountain. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical and performance medicine. Thanks again.